The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
This week sees the return of the annual Maths Week. It's a festival aiming to promote positive attitudes towards mathematics while highlighting the importance of maths in our everyday lives. However, many students may not share such positive attitudes and instead associate maths with feelings of dread or anxiety. Joining me now to explain how we can change maths perception and its teaching, I'm joined by teacher and author of Less Stress, More Success and Discover Maths, Brendan Gilday. Brendan, good morning and welcome.
Morning, Pat. Thank you.
Another Maths Week, and we're trying to convert people to the joys of mathematics.
One of the things I'd probably say at the outset is I would occasionally survey people and say, you know, what is maths? And you get people, the standard answers are all numbers or right or wrong or, absolute truth or something like that. And that's an issue, say, nowadays where many students present with, if you like, an ego threat. And then they get maths anxiety from it. They don't like not knowing the answer. And they could be quite good at other subjects, but they just don't like not knowing. You know, so if you write something in English, more or less, if it's compact and the spelling's right and all the rest, then it's good. But in maths, you could do some good stuff. And if it's wrong, it's wrong.
And the problem is you can spoof in English.
That's right. No spoofing in maths.
No spoofing in mathematics. Although you do get points for a correct approach to the problem.
Oh, no, absolutely. No, absolutely. But I was just meant in general, just talking to people. But for sure, I mean, maths is very friendly. And even nowadays, we'd say, with the new junior cycle, we're now at a stage where collaboration and communication are king. So the maths has been ratcheted back a bit and these two new skills have entered. So if you're doing junior cycle maths now, you have to do a project in second year. It's called a class-based assessment and one in third year. And they're the
And how do they challenge your mathematical abilities, those projects?
Well, now you pick, in second year, you pick something that you like doing yourself. So you might say, I'm interested in space flight or I'm interested in aircraft taking off. And then you go off and you can combine with two or three like-minded people in your class. And you've got 3 weeks to work in class. And come
all right, Sean, you do the maths end of this. I'll do the drawing.
Well, that could be as well. But I think then in the end, they all have to produce an individual report. But I think what's brilliant about it is then you can see how if you were a good talker or a good drawer and you could lean on the maths people, that's the way the world works now, the whole collaboration and communication thing. And that's what we
are there to. People who genuinely do not have a mathematical ability, or is it all conditioned in people? Like it used to be said, girls are no good at maths.
That's right, yeah.
And then, of course, girls get top scores in applied mathematics.
Knock it out
and
of the park. Yeah. I think there's a huge, if you like, what would you call it, vein of people who are very good at maths and maybe or suffer from maths anxiety or were put off or whatever. But there is probably, and according to me, maybe I might say 25% of people or 20% genuinely find it hard. And you could see that if you got to Leaving Cert Maths and there'd be people, say, who decided to do foundation. Now, sometimes it would be a confidence thing, but a lot of the time it'd just be, it'd just be a blur. Yeah. And they just got away from
it. Now, you talk about girls maybe isolating the fact that they might have an issue with the mathematical technique or something early, the lads will ignore it and kind of try.
That's right. The fellas have a thicker skin. I think there's that side of it. I think it's just something there that when you mention it with the gender breakdown, like if I say to somebody like you, you know, maths people, who do you know is a maths person? Yeah. And if you might trot out Pythagoras or Laplace or somebody, a knowledgeable fella like with the mathsy stuff. But a lot of people will throw out men, if you like. Whereas, like, Maths Week now is really about defying the stereotypes, if you like, as I'd say. And if you take, say, a girl called Ada Lovelace, her daddy was Lord Byron, she worked on the calculation machines. And she was one of the first people to write. She was the first person, actually, who wrote a code for computers.
Okay.
And she was able to.
That was 180
years ago. That's right. And she was able to predict how useful computers could be. So nowadays, let's say, you could say with using AI and the whole runaway algorithms, we need to understand the implications for this. So how do we do that? So if there's any Ada Lovelaces out there, we challenge you to get involved.
There's a Katherine Johnson. Who is she?
Catherine Johnson, she only died a couple of years ago, and she was over 100. She worked for NASA doing calculations on space flight trajectories using geometry. And she was doing it by hand. So not only was she brilliant, she was incredibly accurate. Like you and I would appreciate, certainly with me, my accuracy could let me down at times. But she was able to do all these calculations. And I mean, in her case, she was, as I said, she was a black woman. And there'd be no much, if you like, inspiration for people like that. And let's say for me, Matt's Week could be about role models. You know, you can't be what you can't see. So if you're somebody and you know about her or you know about Ada Lovelace, you can be inspired and say, well, OK, if they can do it, then I can do it.
Now, the maths, people just think, you know, primitively they'll say it's sums, you know, adding, subtract, multiplying, dividing and long division and long multiplication and all of that. That's kind of the basic arithmetic. But then the whole mathematical subject encompasses geometry, trigonometry. And
the dreaded algebra.
Algebra. But, you know, trying to explain to someone why they should learn about sine and cosine. I tried to explain, if someone asked me, it's a language. It's a set of definitions, that's all.
Agreed. I think, too, say, with algebra, one of the things, say, is, I'd be asked all the time, what use is algebra? But if people are listening and you just think, take two odd numbers and multiply them together, you always get an odd number. Or do you? And no matter how many odd numbers you pick and multiply them together, there's an infinite number of ones to be checked. But algebra can prove it in three short lines. And as a maths person, you just go, wow. Yeah. Imagine being able to do an infinite number of sums in three short lines. And say that's the power of mathematics that's behind the thing. And say for me, like as a person, if I'm doing the survey and somebody says to me, what use is maths or what good? I would actually argue now in this time in the world, maths will help us either analyse and hopefully survive the climate crisis. We're down to being able, you saw it on the news there recently, where we can predict the path of a hurricane to within plus or minus 40 or 50 miles. And we're getting better at that all the time. But if we're going to cope with this new reality as it comes down the pipe, maths is going to be the king.
But people will say, sure, why do we need maths? Haven't we got computers now? And on top of that, we've got AI. Yeah. Therefore, why should I bother learning my trigonometry if we have all that?
Okay, and a bit of me would say I wouldn't disagree at a certain level. However, we need to understand, we need to be in control of this still. We can't just say we've invented it and then, if you like, walk away. And leave it to AI. And that's the doomsday scenario that we all read about.
Yeah, I mean, who's going to write the algorithms? If the machines are writing the algorithms for the machines,
yes,
we're in deep trouble.
We're in trouble.
Dyscalculia, a condition my daughter has, says one. Can you explain what it is?
Well, just in general.
It's like dyslexia, except for numbers.
Yeah. And it's a big, big problem for people who, let's say, I've come across students who couldn't tell the time on a circular clock. Because it just all got jumbled up, or the hands were moving clockwise, but they weren't getting it. There's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of different words and a lot of different conditions. But I would say to people, just while I think of it, we were talking before, Professor Sue Johnson Wilder is an expert on maths anxiety and mathematical resilience. And if you're a parent or if you're somebody who's concerned, or you've got a student who's struggling with this stuff, then Sue Johnson Wilder is your first port of call. Because if you get to her and just Google her or whatever, there'll be lots of stuff leading off her. And anything that you find leading off her is gold dust. You know, I heard her, I was at a conference in Cork last year, and she's just awesome.
Now, here's one. Can your guest explain, please, how the new maths curriculum is helping students with dyslexia? As my child found the new curriculum a major challenge in the time it took to read, dissect and understand what was being asked before she even got to the maths part. Her maths was stronger than her English, but it suffered due to the wordiness of the questions. I know from talking to other parents and teachers, this is a common problem. And I would tend to agree. You've got Sean is the captain of the ship. It's going from County Louth to County Cork, but it's going via Lambay Island. Da 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 da. The upholstery on the deck chairs is yellow. All this kind of verbiage, and you're trying to figure out what's the bloody problem here.
No, I think like a famous one when this project, what I call Project Maths, when it was mooted first and it came out 1 year in a Leaving Cert, one famous year, the first question in an ordinary Leaving Cert was a full A4 page and there wasn't one number on the page. I kid you not. And that was just, if you like, in my view, a teething issue because the people in charge have to figure this stuff out. There's not a lot. If you have dyslexia or you have any reading issues, it's not helpful and there isn't a lot for you. And all you can do is just get in there and try and pace yourself because the mathematics part is actually easier, but you do have to get into the way, and like Pat, you just said there about the descriptions. It doesn't matter if the deck chairs are red or green, but they're thrown into the question. And sometimes, yeah. I don't mean it's to throw you, but they're trying to have, if you like, real world questions, which is always the kiss of death.
All right, Brendan, the teacher, author of Less Stress, More Success and Discover Maths. Thank you very much for joining us in studio.
Thank you.
Well, now we're also joined by someone who is very adept, I imagine, at mathematics, given that he is a retired Lieutenant Colonel from the Air Corps and also an airport safety auditor. Kevin Byrne. Kevin, you're a mathematical whiz?
No.
Oh, dear.
I'm afraid not. I was actually sick the week they did calculus in my final year like that. And to this day, I must take some lessons from Brendan. I do not know how calculus works, even though it's so vital for navigation and for space flight and all that kind of stuff. I cannot understand it. So maybe I should read Brendan's book
online. Anyway, Kevin, we are going to talk about Boeing and there are numbers involved here.
Indeed. Indeed, it's this is week five of the strike we mentioned, which I thought would be fixed by now. You know, 33,000 workers are on strike. They're members of the IAM union over there, and it's got very serious and very dangerous, I suppose, to some extent, because the company and the workers have lost up to $5 billion. That's $5,000 million in 5 weeks, which is a colossal sum of money, as you can understand. The losses to Boeing suppliers who give the spare parts, you know, the brakes, the engines, the fuselages, all that kind of thing, $900 million so far. So it's a huge hit, not just to the aviation industry, but to whole swathes of the US itself.
And the union has deep pockets, it would appear.
It does, unusually so. For a non-socialist country, the union leader, a man called John Holden, said they've got plenty of money to pay the strike fund, which you'd expect, and they can run for another number of weeks. He said that publicly, so it's probably true. And that, of course, is to put the gun to the head of the new CEO, Kelly Ortberg, who's had a rough ride. She took over from Dave Calhoun, who should have stayed in position until about December. He got so many millions to go, and he obviously left early just before this happened. So
before
it's not a good
trouble.
Place to be. Yes.
Yeah, there's talk of Boeing maybe having to go in to seek Chapter 11 protection.
That's the last cause. If that happens, it's going to have a huge effect on the aviation world in general in that regard. For example, they have agreed to pay $487 million in a fine because they didn't do what they said they'd do after the Boeing MAX accidents, which we discussed here many times. And they're going to spend $455 million on improving their safety and other records. And they're going to be looked at closely by the regulator, which is the FAA. But having said that, their cash cow, so to speak, was the Boeing 737, especially the MAX, and none of those are being built, none are being delivered, and they've also got to do, you know, hundreds of other aircraft on the list, none of which is being made. So they're in a very serious situation. They're supposed to borrow by the end of this month $10 billion, but I don't know who's ponied up that money yet.
Now, the Emirates have a big order with
Boeing. They do. They were very fond of using the Boeing 777. The new version, the X, should have flown and been delivered in 2020. That's 4 years ago. And they may have it in place by 2026, but they won't have it if the strike continues like that. And they ordered 150. Now, I don't know what the unit cost of it is because it's a special deal behind the scenes, but 150 is a huge assembly line, years of production, and they're very upset by that because their aircraft they have now are obviously, you know, running out of time and space.
There's a 767 cargo transporter. They've cancelled it.
They've cancelled it, and in fact, they had orders for them like that, a very efficient aircraft. I've been on them, and they're very good. They do a great job like that. But if they can't deliver, then, of course, their competitors, mainly Airbus, are going to step in that regard. And Airbus have announced hundreds of new aircraft in the last number of weeks. But there's a limit to that because they've got, you know, so many, they've got about 15 to 18 years in some cases, orders, and they can't deliver them all in time. They don't actually need more orders just at the moment. So it's a huge problem for, you know, the entire aviation industry in the US of A.
Now, what are the union looking for? Is it simply pay?
Yeah, it is really
it's
simply
not preservation
pay.
Of jobs because well, they're letting go thousands of people.
I'm glad you mentioned that because, believe it or not, last Friday, Boeing said they're going to let go permanently, which surprised me, 17,000 employees. So you'd have to wonder if some of the people on strike might be on that list. They said they can't afford to pay them in the future because of the huge cash flow problem they have, and yet they have to produce all these aircraft double quick time from various locations.
Without the people.
Yes, yes. So it's going to be a problem in that regard. The pay rise that they turned down, which surprised some people, was as much as 30% over 4 years. And that's pretty good in American terms. They're not known for the generosity. But this guy, you know, the leader of the union, John Holden, said there's a deal to be done. So he may want a couple of more percent in that regard. And he has a gun to their head in almost every respect.
But you wonder what kind of happy workers are sticking the glue on the Boeing going forward, you know?
It's a problem. The entire workforce went on strike with a huge vote towards it. So there's a lot of unhappiness in the company. Mm. So I wouldn't be buying shares this week in Boeing, Pat.
All right. The future of fuel in aviation. I mean, we're a long way from maybe an A320 electric.
Yes, we are. Just in passing, I mean, I'm in the business. I left school 51 years ago. And in that time, the overall fuel efficiency of the global airliner fleet, this is propeller and jet aircraft, it's improved by 80%. Now, that's pretty good, pretty good. Now, we're still using the original kerosene, you know, the aviation fuel, and we're going to replace that bit by bit by the sustainable aviation fuel we've mentioned here. Although, of course, I agree that we need billions of litres of it in different parts of the world. But if an aircraft is delivered in 5-7 years' time, it's going to need liquid fuel of some kind in that regard. Having said that, Airbus is exploring two ways, the hydrogen combustion fuel and the fuel cell propulsion technologies, and they have demonstrators for both types of engines, basically. Now, there's a difference. Hydrogen combustion, as you said before in this programme, is where you have the fuel on board and you feed it in, much the same way as the kerosene would be in the tank. The problem with that is, of course, it's incredibly it's heavy because the tanks have to be squeezed. You've got to put them in a pressurized cell. And if anything leaks, we're in serious trouble because we've seen the movie on the Hindenburg, which was liquid. Yeah. I beg your pardon, it was gaseous, you know, pure hydrogen. It's exceptionally flammable and you have to have protections in that. And aviation safety comes first and foremost. The second one is the fuel cell propulsion, where the little device is in the back of the aircraft or somewhere. It makes its own fuel and it will drive then the electric engines, which we've yet to design to push us through the sky and keep us there.
But there are aircraft flying now.
Yep.
That are purely electric.
There are, but they're very small at the moment. What's going to happen, I think, will be much the same as happened with motor cars. You know, where I know a lot of people have got hybrid cars, you know, they have an electric and a little motor as well, and they work very well, and they get fantastic mileage from that point of view. So a small aircraft in the next 5 or 6 years will be 15 to 20 seaters, and they'll have hybrid electric propulsions on board. They'll have small, you know, propeller-driven aircraft. So they'll take off with electric, and they'll take off with you know, probably propellers or small jets, and then they'll go to cruising altitude where they can switch off the internal combustion engines and they'll fly then on the electric. And then you've got the safety, and that'll be proven over maybe 10 years. Start off small and then they'll move into the heavier ones. For example, electric aircraft, pure electrics for 19 seats, which is a small enough aircraft, they're going to fly again in 6 or 7 years and they'll be proven over 4 or 5 years and they'll be used in the regional aircraft up to the 2030s.
Sustainable aviation fuel, we talked about that before,
yeah.
SAF. I wonder, is Michael O'Leary planning to grow for that? He's bought 2 tillage farms.
he'd need to convert an awful lot just to pay for one day's fuel in his fleet because he's got 600 Boeing 737s. That is a huge fleet and uses a lot. But they have done a deal, Ryanair, with Trinity College to research this matter, and American Airlines are doing the same thing and lots of Middle East airlines are doing the same thing. Sustainable aviation fuel in the short term.
But imagine the choice you have to make between producing food and producing fuel.
It shouldn't be a choice, is my attitude to that. We should be using waste and converting that into sustainable aviation fuel, SAF. And I think that's going to be the short-term prospect.
All right. Very good. Kevin, thank you very much. Ed, we still have Brendan with us, and he's handed me a little volume.
Oh.
It's left-handed or right-handed, an investigation for second class in St. Patrick's National School, Stamullen, written by Emma and Granddad.
That's right.
That gives us a clue, doesn't it?
It gives us a clue. So yeah, it's I think it's very nice. We use the word ratio in the so they can understand between left and right. And then we use the word ambidextrous. And that's big high fashion in education nowadays, where we take a piece of maths and a piece of English and stick
and plug them together. And that's what's going to happen in second class in St. Patrick's. Thanks a million, Brendan. Thank you very much, Kevin, for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.